둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here and checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button if you're not already. You're going to get new interviews just like this one sent your way every single week. You can grab a Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. So, of course, we've had some great guests dropping by lately, including the cast of Shrinking, Jessica Williams, Krista Miller, Ted McGinley, Michael Urie, talking about the season 3 of the Apple TV series. Petula Clark and Don McLean were here. Carney Wilson of Wilson Phillips. We talked with some cast of The Rip, the Netflix movie with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Catalina Sandino Moreno and Sasha Calle both dropped in to discuss that movie. Steven Knight, he created Peaky Blinders, and along with Malachi Kirby, we got to talk about A Thousand Blows, out now on Disney Plus. Nico Case, she's got a brand new record called Neon Gray Midnight Green. Amy Mann, Joe Henry, Karen Berkowitz to talk about the movie Pleased to Meet Me, and Walker Scobell, you know him as Percy Jackson in the Disney Plus series. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, I get to take it all the way back to Louisville to talk to my friend, film producer Gil Holland. In fact, he's going to trace a nearly 30-year career that adds up to probably somewhere around 150 films, from early Sundance breakthroughs like Hurricane Streets, documentaries such as Flow for Love of Water, the beloved Big Star doc that you can see on HBO, plus cult favorites like Greg the Bunny. Remember the Greg the Bunny back on Fox way back in the day? So Gil's going to dig into what a producer actually does, why rejection is basically part of the job description, how the 90s indie boom cracked Hollywood right open, and why that spirit might be poised for a comeback in the age of streaming and AI. And along the way, he's going to explain why Louisville became his home, how Kentucky keeps finding its way into his work, and what's next, including new projects with Sarah Silverman and Bonnie Prince Billy. All that and more as we discuss the Louisville film scene. It's Kyle Meredith with Gil Holland.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm stoked to be here.
Yeah. You and I have known each other for quite a few years now. And when I brought this up and said that I think I might want you as my first guest, you somewhat casually mentioned that you might have more film credits than any other person in Kentucky.
I mean, I have been working on movies for almost 30 years, and if you work on like 5 films a year for 30 years, you somehow get to 150. It just kind of happens.
Yeah. So let's tell people exactly what you do, though. What do you consider your job title?
Right. So you know, it's funny because in Louisville and most of Kentucky, people may not even know I'm really a filmmaker, but in New York City, nobody knows I do stuff like Nulu and Harlan County. I'm only seen as a film producer. So, you know, a producer is the person who finds the script, first person on a project, finds the script, finds the director, raises the money, hires the crew, cast, and then, you know, kind of oversees with the editor, you know, the editing, the post-production, and then the marketing distribution. And it's the first person on a project and the last person, you know, I'm still working on films that were made 20 years ago, still trying to, you know, monetize them and get them out in the world.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Like 20 years ago.
Or like Flow for Love of Water is a documentary about globalization and privatization of water, which was at Sundance in 2005 and played all over the world and has only gotten more relevant post, you know, Flint, Michigan, you know. So every week there's another email from somewhere somebody wants to see Flow.
Jeez. Wow. I mean, I do hear about that sometimes when I'm talking with filmmakers anyway, especially like in the documentary world, sometimes with writers, you know, you'll hear something like, well, I started pitching this, you know, 20 years ago, and it's taken until now to get it made. But rarely do I hear actually someone say like, well, it's there and I'm still working on it.
Well, and for example, we had a happy surprise when our documentary about the band Big Star, all of a sudden HBO Max was like, we want to license that. And that was kind of like out of the blue. We're like, great. We're very excited about that.
Which, by the way, that Big Star, I mean, that's definitely one our listeners here will have seen. We talk about that on, I mean, that you're a part of that, you know, and you have so many credits. That one's on my list, though. That's one of those that it's like, geez, you worked on the Big Star movie.
Well, it started because we were at South by Southwest the week that Alex Chilton died.
Yeah.
And so we were like, oh my gosh, we got to put together a tribute band. And I just worked on a film that Michael Stipe I'd produced a film called Spring Forward with some other folks. And Michael Stipe was the exec producer. And so Mike Mills, I think, was there from REM. And so they were putting together a tribute band. And I found my director. I was like, we need to film this. We need to make a documentary about Alex Chilton. And then, you know, 5 years later, we had a Big Star documentary. You know, it evolved. I don't think any of the footage from that South by Southwest tribute show ended up in the final picture. But it's a beautiful little documentary.
And it's an important part of their story now, too. Do you see Mike Mills when he comes into town? He's here like every
year for
Derby,
right? I saw him
with
the baseball project at Whirling Tiger not too long ago.
Yeah. Good gang there. So let's go back to the beginning there. How did you get into the business? Like, how did you end up here?
Right. Well, growing up in Davidson, North Carolina, not a lot to do. And so movies were a big escapist, a way to travel the world, see foreign language films, you know, collect stamps and coins kind of thing. And my dad was a big film buff. So when I went to college, I wanted to do any film studies class. There was two. And then when I went to law school, I was like, I really want to just do something else. But I worked in a law firm in Paris, France, and one of the clients was a film producer. And I was like, oh my God, people make movies. I'd never met a film producer. So then I went to New York and started interning in a film company.
Could have been a lawyer.
I was basically a glorified paralegal because I never took the French bar or anything.
Uh-huh. Ended up schlumming around here in this industry instead. It's
it's fun. I mean, you know, that was early mid '90s when indie film was really starting to disrupt the Hollywood system, and so it was a very exciting time.
And I did want to talk about that because that is like there are a few points in Hollywood history where that gets to happen, and when we talk about the '90s indie boom. You know, names come up, of course, the easy ones like Linklater and Kevin Smith. And was it Brothers McMullen? Ed Burns. Like things like that. Like I'd love for you to talk about that era just a little bit. Like how did that happen that we got to that spot that really allowed you to kind of find your footing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would go back to John Cassavetes, who I think really kind of started it, making movies with his friends, 16 millimeter, cheap. And then early 90s, you did have the Linklaters, the Slackers, the Jim Jarmusches. And then that was kind of a new definition of independent film. Like we were working outside the studio system. You know, the studios had the heyday in the 70s, made all those amazing movies. 80s, it started feeling like bloated. And so we were like, we could work independently of the studio system, but dependently on all our friends. And we can, you know, work with big actors, but we can, everybody can share in the profit if the film is successful, you know, so we'll disrupt the creative accounting that the Hollywood studios use to try not to actually share any profits. And, you know, we have something to say. And we were also kind of taking a path of the foreign language film, which would show edgier content, gay content. And indie films can do that because you don't necessarily always have to deal with the MPAA. Sure. So we could kind of show new, interesting stories. Queer cinema was a big part of it. And then when the digital revolution happened in the late 90s, then all of a sudden there was a great democratization of the story-making process. Mm-hmm. Because in the old days, you know, to get access to a 35 millimeter camera, you either had to be rich or go to an amazing film school, which costs money. And so there's like, you know, lots of white dudes making movies who maybe don't have that important of a story to tell. And then with digital video, all of a sudden floodgates open. And now filmmaking is just an art form like writing a book or making a painting. You can literally make a feature film on your cell phone.
And we'll be right back right after this. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. February has a funny way of making it seem like everyone else has their love life completely figured out. Whether it's couples, posts, engagement announcements, or just a general noise around relationships, I know it can feel like you're somehow behind. But the truth is, most of us are still figuring it out. Married, dating, single, or somewhere in between. Honestly, that includes me. Relationships are complicated, and they don't come with a rule book. Whether it's learning how to communicate better, letting go of old expectations, or just figuring out what actually feels right at this stage of life, it's a process. And therapy can help take some of that pressure off by helping you understand what feels heavy, what you want, and what might be getting in the way. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. You fill out a short questionnaire about your needs and preferences, and they do the matching work for you. With more than 12 years of experience, over 30,000 therapists, more than 6 million people served worldwide, they typically get it right the first time. And if they don't, you can switch to another therapist from their tailored recommendations. So sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Gil Holland.
Like, I've hoped, because there's still great independent films being made right now. They're still not exactly being seen or celebrated maybe in the same way that they were in that 90s moment that we're talking about. But it feels like we could be getting to that point, especially with the big consolidations that's happening within streaming. I mean, of course, everybody's hearing about Netflix and Warner and all of that. But I don't know. I feel optimistic that there's something that all the big guys are going to be arguing over here, and it's just going to allow for this other thing to happen.
Well, like, I also have a theory. So obviously, like, you know, independent film, we made the change. There are now lots of actors doing interesting stuff, taking risks, working for scale on a low budget film because they believe in it and hope it's going to have a successful critical life and then festival life and then distribution life. You know, look at Sentimental Value, which is a pretty small Norwegian movie, and it's doing amazing. And it's a great movie. And I also think with AI, you know, all these Marvel films are going to be able to be made by, you know, four English majors who are really good at writing prompts. And then you pay some famous actors for their likeness, and they don't even have to show up. And you can make a whole Marvel film with like four people in probably 2 weeks for not very much money. But like indie film, like we don't even use CGI, right? So we will, I think indie film and like actors theater, live theater, just like sports, like, you know, chatbots can't do those things. So I think indie film is actually going to come back in an interesting way. Distribution is always the challenge because, sure. You know, people are used to getting free music, and music is often the canary in the coal mine for the film industry as bandwidth, how Napster, you know, initially destroyed the music industry, and then Spotify has resurrected it as the bandwidth for transmitting, you know, audiovisual images, i.e. movies, has shrunk so much. If you look at how music, everybody thinks music should be free. You know, I'm a little worried at some point everybody thinks movies should be free or just $10 a month, but then you got to get onto Netflix, and then that's hard because they have their gatekeepers.
Sure. Because, you know, a lot of times if I'm looking for something that might fall in this category that we're talking about. Like, my first thought is that probably means I need to go to Prime or Apple and rent it, you know, from there.
Yeah, I mean, it is very hard. Netflix, in the past, Netflix would actually license a lot of independent content, but now they are making so much of their own content, it is much harder to get a film onto Netflix. So, right. And in the old days, you know, Amazon Prime would take pretty much any indie film that played major festivals. They've gotten a little harder to always get to platform your film. So then, you know, then you're looking at Hulu and all these other places and Roku and Tubi and Movie. And, you know, there's all these places, but how do you drive people there?
Sure. Sure. So how's that going for you?
Well, it's always a challenge. Uh-huh. I'm always psyched when somebody sees one of our films, and I'm always like, where did you see it? Because I'm always so curious, like, because, you know, you can't keep track of where it's playing. And then Film Hub is another place where people can kind of upload their own content, and then they're responsible for driving their own eyeballs.
Yeah. Well, and looking back here, because I do want to hit on some of these, because, again, what an incredible list of films that you've been a part of. Headed all the way back to the beginning, there are two titles that I think we should start with, but Hurricane Streets, right? And this was, did you say this is your first film?
Yeah, so I got super lucky. My first film was, I'd started a short film distribution, I guess, company, but really I was stealing an idea from the Paris Review, which was a great, you know, is the great compilation of short literature, short stories. And I said, why isn't there like a compilation of great short films? Mm-hmm. So I started Cineblast, and I met this young director named Morgan Freeman, not the actor, not the Morgan J. Freeman. But we did get good seating at restaurants when we would use his name to reserve tables. And I distributed his short film, and I thought he was super talented. And then I said, you know, and then people kept saying, Gil, you should be a producer. You know everybody. You're honest. You get stuff done. So I was like, sure, I'll try to be a producer. I was like, yeah, I remember that one guy in Paris. He didn't seem that smart. I'm probably as smart as he is. Maybe I could be a producer. And Morgan had introduced me to one person whose film I could never get off the ground. And then Morgan was like, well, what about this one? And I was like, well, this is great. And we literally, and it was an East Village story with these kids, and Brendan Sexton, the third, was going to be in it, who had just done Welcome to the Dollhouse.
I know him as Warren from Empire Records.
And that's right. And so Morgan and I literally got together, and we like put all our credit cards out on a table, and we were like, we could shoot in our apartments. In New York City, you can shoot for free on the streets. So we were like, we can shoot in the streets. We can shoot on my roof. We can shoot in my apartment. You know, I have like 10 grand worth of capacity on my credit cards. He had like 10 grand on his credit cards. And so we basically kind of greenlit ourselves. We were like, we'll shoot on, you know, 16 millimeter or Super 8 if we have to. And then once you greenlight yourself, then people start getting FOMO, trains leaving the station. And then we actually got enough money to shoot 35 millimeter. And we were insanely lucky to get into Sundance and then go. And we were the first film ever to win 3 prizes at Sundance.
Wow.
And, you know, sold to MGM. It was one of the few indie films that sold to a major studio.
Yeah. Well, and when we were talking about that era and everything, because I was thinking of like Miramax. Like, you know, places like that was really kind to some of those stories and everything. But I loved it because you sent me an email about that, and you said, and it's life's been downhill ever since.
Life has been downhill ever since because, you know, you don't realize how hard, you know, I've had so many films rejected from Sundance since then. And, you know, I mean, I've been lucky to have, I don't know, like 14 films that have played there, but 3 times as many, you know. Independent filmmaking is about rejection because, you know, you want an actor to be in it, they reject you. You want an investor to invest in it, they reject you. You want to shoot in this location, they reject you. You want to apply to Sundance, they reject you. You want, you know, Fox to buy your film or Netflix to buy your film, they reject you. So you have to have some thick skin.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you talk about the parallels in music. I mean, 9 times out of 10, it's that debut album everybody still talks about, you know, and then you start to, you know, whatever. But that's almost not a fair comparison when I look at some of these other titles right here.
I mean, I got lucky too, because then my second film, Dear Jesse, was a documentary. And, you know, Tim was like, I was like, I've never done a documentary. I've barely done one feature. But when he told me the premise, I was like, that's an amazing premise for a film. And that was, you know, his special relationship with Jesse Helms as a gay North Carolina writer director who's being represented in the Senate by the guy who calls him the son of Satan. You know, Jesse was notoriously homophobic North Carolina senator. And you know, I mean, Matthew Shepard was in Dear Jesse, and then we got HBO then bought that and was nominated for an Emmy. So I had kind of two kind of big-ish ones out of the box, and then it's been harder.
Well, then, let's see, Sweetland, it's a big winner right there.
Sweetland won the Spirit Award. Sweetland, I'm pretty sure, got rejected from Sundance and then won the Spirit Award for Best First Feature. And I feel like one of the programmers was like, you should have submitted that to Sundance. And I was like, I'm pretty sure I did.
That's usually the way those conversations go as well.
But that was fun because that was Ned Beatty. I did two films with Kentucky's own.
I wrote Ned Beatty down. I noticed that. Yeah. Two films with Ned.
Yeah, actor, theater guy. Yep. And he loves Kentucky. We talked to him, you know, it was fun.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Gil Holland. Desert Blue, what a great cast on a...
Yeah, that was Kate Hudson's first starring role.
Is that right?
Yeah, I saw her last week at the Gotham Awards, so I guess a month ago, in New York. Had not seen her in like 25 years. Yeah, for Song Song Blue. And I'm dying to see that film. Yeah. And she's so great. And I was like, she's going to be a huge star.
My mom called me just yesterday to tell me she had just got out of the theater seeing Song Song Blue, and it's the best thing that she's seen. Yeah. You know, forever.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be great.
Yeah, but that cast, that Desert Blue, and then Adventures of Power, of course, most people know it as the air drumming movie, which I remember, right, that started as a documentary that went into a movie? Is that how it happened, or is it just the movie?
I mean, there is a famous documentary about air drumming. I can't remember if that came before or after our film, but yeah, unfortunately, the Adventures of Power also played Sundance, but it was in the midnight category. And the director, I don't remember this, so I'll say allegedly, but the director says we had some technical difficulties. The movie didn't start till 1. He says Harvey Weinstein showed up drunk, left 15 minutes into it, and then all the other buyers saw him leave, and then they were like, and so everybody says it was like the clunker that was dead on arrival. It's a really good movie.
Yeah.
Jane Lynch, before, you know, Glee made her famous. Adrian Grenier, you know, who's the star of Entourage at the time, which was the biggest TV show. It's a good movie. Ari Gold is super talented filmmaker.
Yeah, sort of. If you see the trailer, it's got that Napoleon Dynamite-esque-ness to it.
Yeah, that was one where I was like, this is going to be a huge hit. And it was basically kind of a financial bomb. And I was just like, it's so weird. Filmmaking is just, it's not necessarily good business. It is definitely a good art sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you get lucky, the art and business come together and you have a financial and critical success.
I mean, that's the great question about all of this. Like, why do you continue to put yourself through it if it's not, you know, because as you said, it's like the line that people say most, I think, in this business, it's impossible to make a movie, right? That's the line. It's impossible to make a movie. So if you can make a movie, like, you've gone beyond.
Well, I, you know, play well with others, team up with tons of people. You know, I see people in L.A. who sell scripts for 10 years and still haven't gotten one movie made. So, you know, I do low-budget films. I know my sandbox. Mm-hmm. I want to work with first-timers that need the, you know, time, talent, treasure, whatever I can bring to the table or my connections. You know, I'm not trying to make the next, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm trying to make a low-budget film that we can raise the money for and get made and kind of help start some careers.
Yeah. Lately, because I'm looking, let's see here, Hazard, Unknown Country, even Night Shift. Like, a lot of these characters are in bad spots.
No, that's funny. Yeah, well, so Hazard we shot up in Harlan County, and then we have two other movies that shot in Harlan County last summer, so they're coming down the pike. So I'm excited about that, just getting more business ecotourism to Kentucky's Appalachia, because I feel like we have an amazing story to tell that Hollywood has often told the negative stereotypes of our Appalachian heritage without seeing all the amazing stories we have. And yeah, sometimes, you know, The Unknown Country, you know, Lily Gladstone, the second movie I worked on with her. And, you know, that one was an amazing story because there was not much of a script. It was like, we're going to have, you know, this amazing Native American actress touring the country after Trump gets elected. And you know, the film's called The Unknown Country. And I met them at a kind of a pitch thing. And I was like, I'm in. This is going to be amazing. And, you know, it was going to be an art, total art project. And of course, then she gets nominated for the Oscar with Martin Scorsese in Flowers of the Killer Moon. And all of a sudden, the film that was the total art project is now selling all over the world. And actually, we might not lose all our money, which would be amazing.
It's funny. Rising tide lifts all ships.
Right.
That's it right there.
But that's why I love indie film, because you don't have to cast somebody to get the money. You know, if you have a story and you can, whether it be nonprofit donations or crowdfunding or, you know, creating an LLC and selling little units in it, somehow you get it made, and then hopefully it finds its life. And then you can really work with some people who are now, you know, so many people now I can't afford to work with anymore because they're all like so famous.
Sure. That's when you call in the favor. Like, you remember I was there at the beginning. I was there. Speaking of the beginning, there was one I missed, and I know I'm jumping around a lot, but Greg the Bunny. What? Tell me the story of Greg the Bunny.
So my great friend Kevin Chenoy called me, and he had just finished Wharton Business School and wanted to get in the film business. And I was like, I don't have any money. He's like, no, I'll work, whatever. So, you know, after 6 months, I'm like, okay, you're my partner now. And his little brother was at NYU, Spencer, and his two best friends, Sean Baker and Dan Milano, and they were doing this goofy little puppet show called Greg the Bunny, and it was awesome. And I was like, oh my God, this is so good. And there was something called Metro TV in New York, and it was like a cable access. And I was like, man, we could really do something with this. These guys are clever. And so I pitched IFC, Independent Film Channel. They were looking for a late night host for this TV, you know, to present these like classic films. And I was like, what if it was Greg the Bunny? And so Sean Baker, so Kevin and I were like basically Sean Baker's first co-managers. They had we created a little company with them called Monkeys with Checkbooks. And they created all these parodies of classic movies, whether it's Jim Jarmusch or Stanley Kubrick or Spike Lee. I mean, like, The IFC Greg the Bunny show is one of the funniest things you will ever see if you can find them online. And then everybody was like, oh, this show is great. So then we cobbled together the two seasons, I think, of IFC into like a 4-minute pitch and found some big Hollywood showrunners and sold a show to Fox. And so had 13 episodes on air, and it starred Eugene Levy played Gil. So that was a little complicated on set sometimes. And Sarah Silverman, it was kind of her first big network show. And that was a really good show. It's not as funny as IFC because we had a little more creative license to be disrespectful maybe to corporate brands that might, you know, not be advertising on IFC, but might be advertising on Fox.
That's where it gets a little bit. And you're still working with Sarah Silverman.
Sarah Silverman, yeah. We actually just shot a film in Louisville that Sarah Silverman is the star in, and it's a drama called The Growing Season, and I don't even know if it's on IMDb yet, but word will start getting out that she was here for a month, and it's going to be a good film.
Yeah. Apparently you didn't sign the nondescript right there. You can still say that part. Which brings us up to the present. Like, so what else? What else are you working on right now?
Right. So, you know, we had a fun fall. We had a documentary we shot in rural North Carolina called Freeman Vines, a short doc that got Oscar qualified. So we did a full Oscar campaign. We did not make the final 15 shortlist, but it was really fun and learned a lot. And there's a lot of lobbying and money that goes into these Oscar campaigns, even for a short documentary. Mm-hmm. And we just got nominated for NAACP Image Award for that film, and it played a lot of festivals. So that's been really kind of gratifying. We got a music-related narrative feature that starts shooting in Louisville next week with our very own Will Oldham, Bonnie
nice.
Prince Billy.
Yeah.
And he's also in The Growing Season with Sarah Silverman. I want to put my friend Will in every movie that we do.
It's always fun seeing him in movies, too.
Yeah, and Allison Russell, the great Grammy winner.
We love Allison Russell.
Will be starring in that. And a couple of other names I'm not sure we can talk about yet. But
yeah, but music-driven.
Music-driven, yeah. It's about a musician having kind of a midlife crisis who'd had a hit as a younger musician and going through maybe some mental – it's a little unclear. I don't want to talk too much about
sure,
it because it's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
And then we have maybe Will Oldham plays an Obi-Wan Kenobi-type character. Nice. But he's also very mysterious.
I hope we can partner up on that whenever that gets released around here.
Yeah, and all the original songs, and it's a singer-songwriter on Sonoblast who is also an amazing filmmaker. I met him first as a filmmaker. So it's kind of all coming together in this movie. It's going to be good.
Beautiful. I want to wrap up, too, with the question. And now that I look at the question, I'm laughing because of what it is. But why Louisville?
Well, I was a trailing spouse, and I'm still here post-amicable divorce. It's an amazing town. It's such a creative town. We have great locations. We have a great tax incentive for films. You know, buildings are like movies, so it's intellectual property or real property. So, you know, in Louisville, I can be a developer, just like I'm a producer, and I find a property, which is like finding an intellectual property, which is a script. And then I hire a director, that's like hiring an architect. And then you have a crew and you have a line item budget and you try to make it and not lose money. And, you know, real estate's a better business per se, mm-hmm. but both of them, you're telling stories. And I like telling stories.
But you've just been such a big cheerleader for this town over these years.
It's an amazing town. I mean, after 10 years living in New York City, and I've traveled, you know, my mom's from Norway. I lived in France and Spain and England. And I've seen a lot of cities. And after 10 years in New York, I kind of joked that I was auditioning cities. Like, where do you move after you have lived in New York City? And because of the vibrant art scene here, which I don't, you know, I give Mayor Farnsley some credit for starting Fund for the Arts, you know, look at like what Teddy Abrams is doing. Look at what the new folks at Actors Theater are kind of bringing back. Look at the history of the Humana Festival. We have amazing creative fabric and the capacity for creatives to live here and support themselves without having to work 80 hours a week like my creative friends in New York. I'm like, why do you still live there? Like, move here and really build your creative brand.
That's your Jedi mind trick, because so many people have moved here because Gil Holland brought them here. Gil Holland, you should move to Louisville. And then they come and I say, how did you come to Louisville? It's like, I know Gil. It's like, of course you do. That's it.
Yeah, but lure them here with, you know, the Derby or Bourbon and Beyond or whatever, and then keep them here. And that's, mm-hmm. and I feel like it's really starting to happen. And AI, you know, I do think AI is going to hollow out a lot of the jobs in LA, but indie film is going to be good. So we do need to get more people from LA and New York to move here.
Well, I know that you can do it if anybody can. And congratulations on, you know, the whole career, but also all of the upcoming stuff that you're a part of. Because again, if you can make a movie, you've already completed the impossible and you just keep making movies. So
keep working. I'm lucky to work with some amazing people and, you know, it's the mayonnaise in the sandwich. You know, you just figure out how you can slot in and be helpful in some way to keep everything moving forward.
Right on. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Thanks, Kyle.
And my thanks to Gil Holland. And to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button before you get out of here to keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions. Anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please do give the series a rating and leave a review wherever you're listening from. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday starting 6 p.m. Eastern. 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music and bonus interviews, lots of music and film news. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Weezer, Susie and the Banshees, the Claypool Lennon Delirium, John Doe, The Who, Brian Ferry, Nick Lowe, The Thrills, Lumineers, Nickel Creek, Sarah Jarosz, Ayanna Lee, Dry Cleaning, Sunny War, The Lemon Twigs, and my interviews with director Paul Feig about The Housemaid, Heather Graham, Hollywood legend Heather Graham, and comedian, actor, musician Tim Heidecker. Just an example of what you get when you tune in weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always at Kyle Meredith. Please do like, follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.